May it please the court. Appellant Mr. Jackson was convicted of robbery in the first degree and armed criminal action related to an incident with coffee shop employee Ms. Leslie Schriffen in August 2009. Surveillance video existed and was introduced of the incident. And although there were two other people present in the coffee shop when the incident occurred, neither of those two other people testified about observing a robbery, otherwise seeing a gun. Therefore, in terms of testimony, Ms. Schriffen's testimony was a critical testimony, could be said. What makes this case unusual or unique is that though her direct examination is recorded in the transcript, Ms. Schriffen's cross-examination testimony is entirely missing from the transcript record due to a court reporter's equipment malfunction.
Didn't the detective's testimony talk about the appearance of the weapon?
Yes, the video was introduced, and during direct examination of an officer, the state asked the officer on the stand to take a look at the video and to describe what he himself perceived in the video.
Wasn't that enough?
Well, in terms of the issues on appeal, I guess there are two issues. The first concerns the general unfairness of having have to proceed on an incomplete transcript. I cited a great philosopher and baseball legend Yogi Berra in my brief. I don't want to similarly get so complicated here. I mean, the argument is simple. I wasn't present at Mr. Jackson's trial. I don't know what errors occurred during the missing.
And you ask us to apply a different standard because you're a new counsel on appeal. Is there any reason, I mean, did counsel die? Is there some reason counsel could not, the rule requires you to make an investigation, to do what you can to fill in things that are missing, including stipulations. Is there any reason that couldn't have been done here?
Well, I guess there are a couple of answers to that. The rule provides for, in the case of missing transcript, that either you attempt to stipulate it, and I believe the language is, or making a motion to the appropriate court. In this case, I think I took one of those two roads. I asked the Court of Appeals to remand the case for a new trial, but importantly, alternatively, to correct the omissions in the record. And I guess once I went down that road, I felt that it was in the hands of the Court of Appeals in that case. And
is that what the case law requires, that you say that you think there's an or? Does the case law make clear what the standard is? Because haven't the cases required a significant effort on behalf of the party who's claiming that they should have a reversal for an inadequate transcript?
Yes. I don't know that there's any cases dealing specifically with stipulation or motion to remand to correct the omissions. I don't think there's cases detailing that distinction there.
Well, didn't this court just last month hand down a case that reaffirmed our prior holdings that the fact that a record's incomplete or inaccurate does not automatically warrant reversal of the appellant's conviction? The appellant is entitled to relief only if he or she exercised due diligence to correct the deficiency in the record and he was prejudiced by the alleged defense. So what's your due diligence here?
The due diligence in this case is that as soon as I noticed that there was a missing portion of the transcript, contacted the court reporter. She wrote a note in the transcript file, a certification that it was incomplete, it was missing. At that point, I filed a motion with the Court of Appeals asking that it be remanded.
Remanded for what?
Remanded to correct the omissions in the transcript. In other words, I was looking for an order from the Court of Appeals directing myself, the prosecutor, the judge, to get together and see if the parties to the trial.
And that relief was denied?
That relief was taken with the case. And so, of course, this case was before the Court of Appeals before it arrived here. And the motion to remand to correct the omissions was filed, I think, several months before the brief. And so, I believe the Court of Appeals issued an order shortly before the case was submitted on the briefs that motion to remand to correct the omissions would be taken with the case. And so it's our assertion that our due diligence was that. We attempted to correct it. We had hoped that the Court of Appeals would have, if not remanded for a new trial, at least remanded to correct omissions, and so in that way. And in fact, in the motion, there's some language that we write that, I mean, the whole purpose of that motion was so that we could be found to have met our burden of due diligence. So,
The problem with the court reporter's machine was known at the time of trial. And you have in your brief that the trial court actually acknowledged the lack of a record. Can you clarify for us how that was actually handled at the time it became known there was not a recording of the testimony of the victim?
That's a little bit unclear. This was aside from pretrial conference, which occurred on May 3rd, this was essentially a two-day trial. The testimony that's missing occurred on the first day of trial. That was May 4th. Ms. Schriffen testified. Her direct examination was cut off. Her cross-examination was entirely missing. That's on May 4th. On May 5th, the judge immediately, at the beginning of the day, makes a statement that he realizes that the part of the witness's testimony from that next day, May 5th, might not have been recorded, so the parties went back and re-recorded, it seems, the testimony of the two other witnesses in the coffee shop. And so in a way, I mean, it was known, but I don't know that it's clear to what extent it was known. In other words, it might only have been believed that the two witnesses from May 5th had not been recorded, and nothing really was mentioned about May 4th, which is Ms. Schriffen's testimony.
But no attempt was made at that time to recall the witness or
anything? No, I mean, assumption. I assume that it's because Ms. Schriffen's testimony was May 4th. She was excused as a witness. This is the whole next day where they realized that. But you're right. No attempt was made.
You're asking, in this court, you haven't asked us to remand that I see. You're asking us to assume that what was there would have presented something that might have helped you on appeal, but you don't say what that was. And I understand you're saying you're new on appeal, but does that mean that we just have to, if there's new counsel, we just do it over? Or do you have some obligation to say she was questioned about matters that you know, affected her ability to, you know, that showed she didn't get a good look at the weapon, or you know, there was a hearing on that wasn't recorded on the issue of a motion to suppress and so forth, and be more specific as to what it would have shown and why you think you need more detail.
I think there are two questions, and one is the general unfairness, is what Your Honor is saying. We are asserting that it's just plainly unfair to require us to demonstrate specific detailed prejudice in the face of a missing transcript. We don't know what we don't know. But there is an argument about specific prejudice, keeping with the Missouri's current law about having to show due diligence, number one. Number two, having to show specific prejudice. The second claim here on appeal is that the lesser included instruction denied by the court, it was erroneously denied by the court. The videotape would have supported that instruction, we are claiming. But importantly, the missing transcript testimony of Ms. Schriffen might have supported the trial court's giving of a lesser included instruction concerning that there was no weapon.
And if I understand correctly, the law would only have required proof that she reasonably believed there was a weapon, not just that there was a weapon. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what is the basis of your suggestion that that the jury might have found that she didn't reasonably believe?
Well, this was the argument from trial counsel. He, I mean, it's true that in a robbery in the first degree, it doesn't necessarily matter whether there's in fact a gun. It's whether the person subjectively believes that there's a gun. In this case, trial counsel at trial argued that because of the video, that the jurors could have disbelieved that she believed that there was a gun. In other words, he was attacking somebody has to reasonably believe that there's a gun. If I hold up a pitcher of water and the person says that's a, you know, person claims at trial that that's a gun, but you can clearly see it's a pitcher of water, that's not going to be reasonable belief. And so I think it was an argument taken off of that, that her belief had to be reasonable, and it wasn't. The
but guess, I mean, if I'm understanding your argument, a prejudice has to be that, or as to that lesser included, that the jury could have found, viewing the video and seeing he was holding something at her back, that she didn't reasonably believe that was a gun.
That's true. In the video, along with the cross-examination testimony, which we don't know, could have supported that. The video is, I wouldn't agree with the state that it clearly shows a gun, but in terms of what she reasonably believed, I mean, there's other certain questions that are relevant to the jury, whether she had the ability to perceive the object, whether she reasonably believed, based on all the factors, that it was a gun, whether that belief was reasonable.
There was some discrepancy in the evidence as to the type of metal that she said it was shiny metal, and there was other evidence that it was a dark object. Is that right?
Yes. In contrast, I guess the state's assertion that it's clearly a gun, she testified, Ms. Riffin testified, that it was silver revolver. She said she looked at it, it was a silver revolver. But as was asked earlier, the officer, in fact, himself took a look at the video, and he didn't describe a silver revolver. He said it was a black handgun. So there are some differences in terms of two people looking at the video and talking about what they
And what was the testimony of the other two ladies who were in the coffee shop? Because there was some cross-examination about it could have been a cell phone. Did they actually concede it could have been a cell phone, or was that just a question?
No, the concession that it might have been a cell phone was with the officer. The other two witnesses at the coffee shop really had, aside from identification evidence, had nothing really to add. They didn't even know a robbery was occurring during this time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. With regard to the first issue, the incomplete transcript, there was a motion filed in the Eastern District Court of Appeals asking for a remand for a new trial on the basis that the available record wouldn't be enough to review the claim that the lesser included offense instruction should have been given. I responded to that motion at the time and reviewed the available record. And looked at the arguments that were made by defense counsel, looked at the evidence that was available there, and suggested to the Court of Appeals that the appellant had not alleged sufficient facts showing prejudice under the standard rule, which is that you have to show both due diligence and prejudice before you're entitled to a new trial.
Why would the state have opposed remand so there could be an attempt to reconstruct the record?
The state opposed remand for a new trial. The state didn't necessarily oppose remand to reconstruct the record. In fact, I probably cited the Cooper case in my response. And in that case, I was involved in a case where three co-defendants were all tried together. Cooper was one of them. And the court reporter's tapes, some of the tapes were stolen. And so the state's rebuttal witness, closing arguments, closing, I think the instruction conference, all of those sorts of things were missing from the record. Two of the defendants in that case asked for a remand, and the case was remanded, and we worked it out with the trial court. The trial court certified certain factual questions, and then that record was then sent back up to the Court of Appeals for the court to review. The state would not have opposed anything along those lines to establish what was in fact missing. The problem
Are you familiar with Shockley, where just recently this court
Yes.
exercised that procedure?
Yeah, and frankly, the state doesn't really have a problem with that procedure, but it wasn't requested in this case. The remand that was requested was for a new trial.
Opposing counsel says he filed a motion that was taken with the case to remand to reconstruct the record.
I don't think he requested to reconstruct the record. I may have misspoken there slightly. He may have asked just for a general remand, for asking the court to correct the omission. In other words, to try and recreate the entire missing cross-examination. I don't think that the court saw that as a viable answer in the case, and probably didn't see it as necessary because he hadn't identified anything in particular that was missing.
When you have the cross-examination of the key witness, isn't that pretty hard to identify what nuances or what questions could be raised from the testimony?
It may be, but some effort should be made to identify what relevant information is going to be there. And there's more than one way to do that. We don't know what we don't know, but we can know what we don't know if we make an effort. And in this case, there are various things that could have been done. Counsel could have talked to trial counsel and said, tell me about the cross-examination. Tell me what you were able to uncover. Perhaps trial counsel had a list of the questions that were posed. I think that's not uncommon in preparing for trial, the cross-examination questions we've written out. If that evidence exists out there, we might be able to easily reconstruct those specific portions of the record.
And you don't think that kind of action would be encompassed in the motion for remand that was filed?
No, I don't think he asked for that. And there may have been a general request to correct an omission, but what was missing, and what I think was critical for the Eastern District's consideration of that motion, was a specific request that the trial court certify some aspect of the case, some important, relevant aspect of the case that would help them review the claim that the appellant was wanting to raise on appeal.
Mr. McElprain?
Yes.
Irrespective of the issue concerning the missing transcript, explain to me why this case shouldn't be reversed based upon the failure to give the requested lesser included offense instruction.
Well,
in particular, reference to State versus Williams.
Right. Essentially, the only time the trial court is obligated to instruct down is when there is evidence, some affirmative evidence, from which it can be inferred that a material element of the greater offense is lacking.
Didn't State versus Williams clearly indicate that the jury has the right to believe or disbelieve any, all, or part of the testimony of any witness?
Somewhat laid to rest
the idea that the defendant had to produce any evidence to get a lesser included offense instruction.
Well, and there's two parts to that question. Did it say that the jury could disbelieve evidence? Yes, it did. And I think that concept is well-settled concept in terms of discussing when the evidence is sufficient to support a particular conviction. Under those circumstances, when you're asking, is a particular conviction supported by the evidence, you look at it in the light most favorable to that particular verdict, the jury can disbelieve
whatever
it wants.
No, that's for sufficiency, but for the question of lesser included, you wouldn't do that.
No,
you'd do it the other way.
For the question of lesser included, I think you have it at two points. You have, would there be a basis to convict of the lesser, in which case you have to ask, is there sufficient evidence of the lesser? And there almost always is. If you've got evidence of the greater, you're virtually always going to have evidence of the lesser. The other question is, is there a basis in the evidence for a verdict of acquittal of the greater? And the other part of your question was, hasn't it been laid to rest that the defendant doesn't have to produce that evidence? And absolutely that's been laid to rest. And I think that was made plain in Santillan. It was reiterated in Pond. But that's not the state's position in this case. It's not that the defendant must produce some affirmative evidence. There just has to be some affirmative evidence in the record.
What distinguishes this case from Williams? I can't figure out why Williams doesn't control.
Maybe well, there are a couple of things that would distinguish the case from Williams. First would be that in Williams there was some affirmative evidence that there was no force used in the robbery in that case. There was testimony of what appeared to be a drug transaction without any force in that case. And this court commented on that in outlining the facts. And so in that case, there was an affirmative basis in the record to say there wasn't force, and thus the lesser instruction should have been given. Now, I will admit that the Williams opinion went on to state and talk about that the jury's ability to disbelieve the evidence might also provide a basis. But an important point there is, I think, this court's earlier decision in Olson, which was only partially overruled in Santillan and again in Pond. Not again in Pond. I guess Pond was really only overruling cases since Santillan that had relied on Olson again from the Court of Appeals. But in the Olson court, this court specifically said that the jury's ability to disbelieve evidence is not in itself enough to form a basis to acquit.
Well, if this court reads Williams to overrule Olson on that point or disagrees that it was just saying defendant doesn't have to prove it, but reads Williams is saying there doesn't have to be affirmative evidence. The jury can simply disbelieve that there was a gun. or that she was afraid or reasonably believed it was a gun, then are we required to remand because there should have been a lesser included offense instruction?
If this court holds that Williams was overruled Olson in its entirety, then probably yes.
Or putting it another way, because without regard to Olson, if the court believes the law is that if the jury were to disbelieve her testimony that he held a gun there or that she reasonably believed he held a gun, then it would be second degree and not first degree. Why isn't that a question for the jury and where the defendants asked for an instruction that should be given?
Well, I think it's not a question for the jury, first off, because the legal standard contained in Section 556.046 is a legal standard that the trial court applies as a gatekeeper to the evidence. And under the rule that the court outlined in Olson, there has to be some affirmative evidence, some affirmative inference that the jury could draw from the evidence to support the lack of the greater.
Was the Olson case discussed in the Williams case?
I do not believe it was discussed in the Williams case. I recall Olson. I will stand correct if I'm wrong. I recall Olson being discussed in passing in the Pond case, because Pond reiterated the holding of Santillan, and the court said to the extent that those cases that rely on Olson have held that the defendant must produce affirmative evidence, they're overruled. In Santillan, the court said something very similar. It said to the extent that Olson and another case, Chambers, could be read to suggest that the defendant must produce that evidence, they are overruled.
What do we take from the fact that defense counsel strategically as an advocate felt like at least one element in this case wasn't believable and that justified the lesser included offense?
Well, I'm sure that defense counsel believed that one or two elements were not believable, and that was the argument that defense counsel made to the jury. I would expect defense counsel to try and find reasonable doubt in every part of the state's case if possible. What's important, though, I think, is not defense counsel's belief, but what the evidence shows and the trial court's consideration of that evidence. And in this case, the trial court essentially
would the defense counsel in this case been subject to ineffective assistance of counsel if he had not asked for a lesser included offense instruction?
Well, that raises an interesting question: whether defense counsel can ever be ineffective under those circumstances, because as I argued probably just within the last month, I don't think you can show prejudice from counsel's failure to request a lesser included offense instruction. Now, it's arguable that there could be that it would be reasonable or unreasonable under the circumstances of a given case for counsel not to ask for it. But ineffective assistance of counsel has two prongs, both the reasonableness and the prejudice.
I have two questions. One, Williams does refer to Olson in saying that the court should not have relied on three intermediate court of appeals cases because these three cases rely on the previously overruled case of State v. Olson. Second, here, what they're alleging is that the missing testimony of the victim may have supported their argument that it was not reasonable for her to believe, or she didn't believe, that there was a gun pointed at her back. So in this combination of circumstances, I'd like you to address where there's not an obligation of defendant to put on affirmative proof, where if this court believes Williams held or we hold that there's no obligation to have an affirmative evidence, why the lack of an ability of this court to look at the victim's testimony in deciding whether that doesn't affect the decision whether or not it was reasonable for him to request a lesser included offense.
Right. And Williams' reference to the previously overruled Olson, I'd forgotten that. I thought that was only in Pond.
I wasn't sure myself, but I pulled it up.
But, you know, when it referred to the previous overruling of Olson, I think you have to look at what the previous overruling was. And it was limited. It was not a complete overruling. In Santillan, the court said, to the extent that it can be read to suggest that the defendant must present that evidence, it is overruled. But there's another aspect of Olson which is very important and I think has never really been abandoned or expressly overruled, which is that Olson stated that the jury's ability to disbelieve is not enough. Now, I will concede that if the court now believes that the law is and that Wilson overruled Olson to that extent
Williams,
as well,
Williams,
excuse
yeah.
me, that Williams overruled Olson to that extent as well, then probably the trial court should have instructed down because, and the trial court should instruct down in virtually every case. Because
well, in every case where it's asked to do so.
Well, right, where it's asked
or
to do so.
Or the rule would allow it to do it on its own motion.
Right. The Section 556.046 is entirely permissive in terms of instructing down on the court's own motion.
But
if it wants to instruct
if
down, it,
if
it can.
If it's requested and if it's supported requested, by the evidence.
And if it's requested, it will always be supported by the evidence, I think is what it comes down to. At which point, one questions why the legislature even included that first prong, that the trial court is only obligated to instruct down if there's a basis for a verdict to acquit. Because there will always be a basis to acquit if the jury can simply disbelieve some part of the evidence.
Well, isn't that statute somewhat based on concepts of double jeopardy and lesser included offenses?
Well,
I mean, irrespective of that statute, how's the court? I mean, that's why we have lesser included offenses. So if you lose on the higher charge, you can't come back and charge on one with the same elements, just one missing, right? That's a double jeopardy concept, not necessarily a statutory interpretation concept.
The statute does in part, I guess, relate to double jeopardy, but I don't think the statute is a double jeopardy statute.
Well, how do we tell if something's a lesser included offense?
Not necessarily with the same test that you would use for double jeopardy. The Blockberger test, the standard test for double jeopardy, says that you look at the elements of the offense. Under Section 556.046, there are, I think, four different ways that something can be a lesser included offense. One of them matches the Blockberger test, the elements test. The others do not. For example, one of the other ways is for the legislature to specifically designate something as a lesser degree offense. And so it doesn't really match the Blockberger test. I think that there are parts of that statute that align with and relate to double jeopardy. And certainly, double jeopardy principles would preclude retrial on a lesser included offense if there's an acquittal on the greater. No question about that. But the question here is whether the trial court is obligated when requested to instruct down. Now, it doesn't violate double jeopardy. It doesn't violate principles of notice to the defendant to instruct down on any lesser included offense. This statute also tends to relates to the due process requirement of notice in addition to double jeopardy, because a defendant can't be convicted of a crime unless the defendant's on notice that the defendant's been charged with that crime. This statute definitely puts defendants on notice that everything that's a lesser included offense is charged. But it also outlines those circumstances when the trial court is obligated to instruct down and when the trial court can, on its own motion, instruct down. And so if the obligation only arises when there's a basis for a verdict to acquit, it seems that the legislature put that in there for a reason, for the trial court to act as a gatekeeper and consistent with prior court precedent here interpreting that statute, that it's not automatic upon request. And that a lesser included offense instruction is not required in every case where it's requested. This court seemingly affirmed that in Santillan, even, which overruled Olson to a certain extent, when the court indicated that Meese had ongoing viability. In Meese, the state successfully argued, and this court held, that the lesser offense of murder in the second degree did not have to be submitted. And I see that I'm well over my time.
You are, but I don't, excuse me, I'm not sure I heard an answer to Judge Stiff's last question. That being, if she has to testify whether or not this was reasonable, that this was a dangerous instrument or deadly weapon, why wouldn't that cross-examination be important?
Well, what the jury had to find was not that she reasonably believed that he displayed a deadly weapon, but that he displayed what appeared to be a deadly weapon. And why would the cross-examination not be relevant? Well, it could be relevant. But what we don't have in this case is any indication that she said something relevant on cross-examination. There's never been an allegation of something she said, for example, an admission that maybe she didn't see what she thought she saw, or an admission that it could have been something else. In fact, if you look at the remainder of the record, if you look at defense counsel's arguments at the instruction conference and in closing argument and at sentencing and the prosecutor's arguments and the allegations in the motion for new trial, the only basis that defense counsel ever really identified for saying that the jury could find that he did not display what appeared to be a gun was the still shots from the video, which were selectively taken out, and the fact that the jury could disbelieve what she said, which indicates that she was steadfast in her testimony.
But doesn't Williams specifically say that's enough? It says, here as in Pond, the state relies on pre-Santillan cases and argues a defendant is not entitled to a lesser included offense instruction merely because the jury might disbelieve some of the state's evidence. And it's not saying defendant's evidence, it's saying evidence. And in Pond, the court rejected the state's argument.
And I think that's the crux of point two. What the rejection of the state's argument was in Pond and in Centillon. Was it that those cases should not be relied on to the extent that they require the defendant to produce it, or was it that the jury can simply disbelieve it? Williams is the first and only decision from this court that has made a suggestion along those lines. Every other decision up to that point has said there has to be some affirmative evidence, some evidence, and the decisions have merely held, and in rejecting Olson, that it doesn't have to come from the defendant, which the state does not at this point contest.
And are there still photos that additional evidence?
In this case, I would argue no, because the evidence was the videotape, and a couple of still photographs were selectively taken out. Now, the officer was asked to look at a couple of those, Exhibit A, Defense Exhibit A, Defense Exhibit C, and he said, looks to me like a gun, appears to me to be a gun. To the extent there may have been a still photograph that was, you know, one frame that was pulled out where you can't see an object, that's really, I don't think a reasonable juror would look at that and say, yeah, I'm going to infer that he didn't display anything, because that's really a misrepresentation of what the evidence in fact was, which was the video, which showed the defendant using an object that appeared to be a gun and acting in a manner consistent with an armed robber, holding it to the victim's back, moving her about, and getting her to comply with his demands. This case, all of the evidence in this case is consistent with an armed robber moving this victim about the store and obtaining money under the threat of force.
Great. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Just a brief point of clarification. In the motion to remand with the Court of Appeals, it was asked to remand for a new trial or in the alternative to correct omission. Specifically, it was requested that it be remanded for a new trial so that a complete record can be made. Alternatively,
we have a copy of it.
Okay. So it was requested that alternatively it be remanded to correct the omissions. Regarding the second point in the lesser included instruction, I think what has only been briefly talked about is what effect the missing transcript testimony would have had on the judges, on the error, possible error in not requesting a lesser, and not granting the lesser included instruction. And I think the Williams case applies, but Pond, I think, is exactly on point. In Pond, it was a cross-examination testimony of the victim of a sexual assault who kind of wavered or, I guess, waffled, for the lack of a better word, on what actually occurred. And based on that, based on the cross-examination answers, and for that reason, the lesser included instruction was, by this court indicated was required to give the lesser included instruction in that case. Well, exactly in this case, we don't know what the missing transcript testimony would have been. And I mean, in terms of when there's a missing transcript, if the court's wanting us to allege prejudice, this is to satisfy our burden of demonstrating that the missing transcript testimony would have helped the trial. This is exactly that. It's the missing transcript testimony or cross-examination testimony, exactly like in Pond, would have supported the lesser included instruction.
Leaving aside the missing transcript portions, is it your argument that the jury could have disbelieved her testimony that she thought he was threatening her with a weapon, and on that basis the lesser included instruction was required?
That is our argument. That's our argument here on appeal, and that was exactly trial counsel's argument. His kind of vehemently at the instruction conference set that out and said that for that reason the judge should request the lesser included, should grant the lesser included instruction. That was the theory of the defense.
And is it your argument that all of that holds whether she waffled on cross-examination or not, that the jury could have disbelieved her no matter what she said on cross-examination?
Well, I mean, as in Pond, it was because of the waffling that the court said that the jurors could have believed her inconsistent cross-examination answers rather than her direct examination answers, and for that reason could have found.
You would agree with the state then that there has to be something in the record on which the jury will disbelieve the evidence. They can't just simply disbelieve it and on that basis require the lesser.
I don't know that we would agree with that, but importantly in this case, I don't know that we even need to address that because there is that some evidence. The videotape is that some evidence. It's videotape is what happened. It's a reproduction of the actual scene. The jurors could have, regardless of whose instance the video was introduced at, the jurors could use their eyes and determine what actually happened. And that also applies for the cross-examination testimony, too.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.